an alien starship with an insatiable curiosity about Earth's science fiction and fantasy trivia. The crew, two hapless astronauts who have spent their lives immersed in strange new worlds of the imagination. Now, Rob Wickings and Clive Ashenden roam the universe, trying to find the way home, seeking to define the A to Z of SFF.
I really love Peter Davison. I love the Fifth Doctor. I think he's so much fun, and there's so much good stuff with all the hundreds of companions that you seem to fit into the TARDIS at any one time. Let's talk about. I really like Kinder. Let's talk about Kinder, shall we?
Yes, let's talk about Kinder. I have to say I love this particular episode of Doctor Who. Confession time. I saw this at probably at the age of about seven, and it made a very strong impression on me, and to the point where it gave me nightmares. So I was almost afraid to revisit it for years afterwards because I thought it couldn't possibly live up to it, and also it has a certain reputation for dodgy effects. So I thought, oh, I'm just going to come back to this and it's just going to look rubbish and I'll be sad. So I didn't go back to it for a while. And then when I did go back to it, I was really pleasantly surprised that, you know, a lot of the things I loved about it at the time were still there. And actually, once you dig into it as an adult, it's quite a rich episode, I think, in terms of sort of themes and the writing. And there are some production issues and, you know, effects of the time issues, but I think if you can look past that, then you've got a really, really strong episode of 80s Doctor Who here.
Yeah, I agree with that. I have to admit, I didn't catch it at anything like as impressionable an age as you did. It was much, much later for me. It's got all the flaws of 1980s Doctor Who in terms of the cheap production standards, but at the same time, as you say, Clive, it's well written. It's got some really interesting things going on in terms of theme and content, and it does to a certain extent start to actually transcend those production values and become something a bit more. So let's start off. Why don't you run us quickly through the plot of Kinder?
Okay, as quick as I can. This is one of those stories where you arrive almost like in media res, right? The story has already begun. It's just that the Doctor and the TARDIS crew just happen to sort of stumble into something. So things start off quite quickly. So you have the Fifth Doctor, played by Peter Davison, and at this stage his crew are Tegan, Adric, and Nyssa, although Nyssa basically gets packed off to the back to the TARDIS and it isn't seen for the whole rest of the story. She comes back right at the very end, like, did I miss anything? Which is one of those unfortunate things where the writer was contracted to do the script, like, in the Fourth Doctor era. And where at that time there were only two companions, so rather than have them go back and do a page one rewrite, they just sort of retrofit this bit of Nyssa is affected by the planet in some way and feels very sick and has to go and sleep.
Yeah, so you do end up with just the two companion kind of a deal on this one, which is probably just as well. I mean, the one thing that I always find about the whole the companions around this sort of time is that I find all three of them pretty spectacularly annoying. So quite pleased, quite pleased to see Nyssa disappear, but it means, well, we don't really see that much of Tegan either all the way through. She spends a fat chunk of the episode asleep, which, yeah, in a good way.
In the first and second episodes to a degree, yeah. But, I mean, I think actually the whole story is a good one for Tegan, but we'll come back to that, I think. So, yeah, so they arrive, Nyssa goes and has a sleep, and at this point they also write out the sonic screwdriver because it's being used for this healing device that Nyssa's going to sleep with. Mm-hmm. They find this, you have this situation on the planet where it's this jungle planet, and you have a tribe called the Kinder, who seem to be these humanoid inhabitants who are telepaths, but don't seem to sort of speak in any way. We later find out that actually there are sort of priestesses who have the voice, and who are sort of the leaders of the tribe, spiritual leaders. But the whole, everything is being thrown out of balance by these, by an expedition, which is based, we get a very sort of explicit sort of, analog for British colonialism here.
Boy, don't we though. I mean, the crew of the colonial expedition, I mean, you know, talking sort of Raj era colonization, these guys are actually dressed up in pith helmets and things like that. That's how explicit it is. And it's all very much kind of a gruff colonel and a slightly flaky kind of adjutant. And Nerys Hughes.
And Nerys Hughes, as the scientist, Todd.
Yeah, who's bizarrely dressed in this kind of sexy nurse outfit throughout. Or is that just me?
I think that's just you. I didn't particularly notice what she was wearing, there we go. You have this sort of skeleton crew of three. The colonial mission was basically sort of to survey the planet and see whether it can be colonized. So they're there taking samples, surveying the natives, and it's basically evincing all the sort of most like heinous and racist attitudes of British colonialism. You know, the sort of this very patronizing, we're superior to them attitude to the native populations, the idea that they're bringing civilization.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of on the nose, but at the same time, it kind of works because it is such a broad parody of that kind of colonialist outlook. But unfortunately, these guys seem to have bitten off a little bit more than they can chew, because the colonial expedition members all seem to be disappearing off into the forest and not coming back. So are they going native? I don't think we ever actually find out what happens to them, but
there's enough information for you to sort of figure out what's happened, I think, later on. Yeah. You have the Kinder, and then you have the sort of colonial expedition. As part of this sort of exploring the planet, our TARDIS crew come across a strange tree, don't they?
Yes, or rather it's kind of a, what would you say? It's like chimes, basically, which sort of rattle away in the best sort of radiophonic workshop kind of synthy kind of a way. But these chimes have a what would you say, that they have a kind of hypnotic effect and basically send poor Tegan off to sleep.
Yeah, it's she finds she's a bit fatigued. It's something about the planet seems to make all the women crew of the TARDIS sleepy, it seems. But so she sort of say, I'm just going to sit here and rest my eyes for a moment while Adric goes off, and the doctor goes off to make sure he doesn't get into trouble, because that's what Adric does. She falls to sleep and has a very, very disturbing dream.
Oh, my word. Now the dream sequence in Kinder is probably the strongest part of the whole episode, certainly to my mind. It kind of comes across as almost David Lynchian, I guess. It's all done sort of in this sort of black void, and Tegan and the characters that she meets are a kind of lit with this really intense kind of sidelight that bleaches out their features to a certain extent and dehumanizes them. So you've got this whole kind of weird theatrical thing going on, where she basically encounters the real villain of the piece.
Yeah, I mean, initially she encounters these almost like warped versions of Adric and Nyssa, who, you know, at the beginning of the episode, we saw them playing a game of drafts, and then we see these sort of strange, almost like Jacobean sort of parodies of them. Mm. Yeah. playing this game and ignoring her, and it's on this black void where we just sort of get glimpses of the shapes, and it's done in this this very kind of 80s video music video sort of style. It's almost like it could be from like a Visage video or something like that. It has this this, was it posterization or solarization thing going on as well.
Well, I think most of that is just purely down to the harsh lighting that they're using. I see what you're getting at there, but it's very stylized, certainly, and that kind of adds to the whole sort of creepiness of it. So Tegan, after meeting these two strange drafts players, comes across this other character, and this is, well, I guess this is the embodiment of the villain, the Mara.
Yeah, this kind of figure of the trickster, and is this almost like, he almost looks like the Joker out of Batman, you know, the sort of, he's partly because of the way it's lit, you know, this sort of smiling, white-faced, white-faced villain who sort of plays all these mind games with Tegan, you know, initially preying on her sort of fear of being alone, and then sort of, it's interesting how it's done, because it's like all the dream stuff is intercut with what's going on back on the planet. Hmm. So we're sort of, we get little snatches of it, but we can see Tegan get more and more distressed by this, and then she gets presented with her own doppelganger, and is asked the question, which one of them is the real one?
Hmm.
And then it gets even more disturbing, right?
Oh God, yeah.
Well, initially, there's this whole idea of which one of them's the real one. And so then he makes it even harder. When suddenly there's 10 Tegans. Until he sort of brings them back together when she's sort of kind of vulnerable, and then you get what is possibly the most kind of nightmarish idea in it, which is this: when you're in a dream space where there is no sense of time, the threat that, you know, if you don't let me have possession of your body, then I'm just going to leave you here, is really, really existentially scary. This idea that you can just be in this nothing place forever, at least as perceived by you. Right. So you can see why she accedes to the guy's demands, because it seems so hopeless. She has no way out.
Yeah, definitely. And so in order to he basically lays hands on her to sort of seal the deal, as it were. So it's kind of like a handshake deal. But in doing that, this tattoo of the snake that he has going on up his arm transfers onto Tegan. And the next thing we see, we're back in the real world or back on the planet. And Tegan wakes up and she's suddenly got the look of the Joker type guy. So she's got this sort of almost red eye makeup on and these weird kind of slightly reddish teeth as well, as if she's been sort of munching down on a too rare steak or something. It's a really simple look, but it just works so brilliantly because it's blatantly obvious what's happened, that she's been taken over by this horrible kind of demonic presence.
Yeah. And then you get this kind of it's almost like kind of version of the sort of story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, right?
Yeah, which is a bit on the nose, but yeah, it does kind of work. So you get this basically Tegan tempts one of the kinder into basically becoming the leader by again sort of doing the transfer again. So.
Yeah, I mean, it, like she literally throws apples on his head, you know.
Yeah.
And then lures him. I mean, it's partly with sort of feminine wiles, partly with the sort of hint of you could have power, but it's also with the fact that the character Aris, played by Adrian Mills, his brother is one of the kinder who are being held hostage by the colonials.
Mm.
So it's like, you know, if, you know, I can give you the power to get your brother free. So, you know, so his motives seem pure, but he's then corrupted by the kinder.
Hmm. So he basically becomes this again, sort of red-eyed, red-teethed kind of monster. But because he suddenly has the ability to speak, which is the something that the rest of the kinder don't do, this fulfills a prophecy that that basically he becomes their leader, and his first act as leader is to basically encourage the kinder to get rid of the outsiders, to protect their land and wipe out the dome.
Yeah, I mean, there's the only opposition to this is from the leader Panna, who's this who's a blind seer character, who is one of the other two characters who have the voice. So you have Panna, and then you have her sort of apprentice Karuna, and into this sort of, you know, and sort of going between this sort of mix, you have, you know, the Doctor and Adric, although Adric ends up sort of stuck in the base, where there have been developments, haven't there? whilst all that's been going on, Hindle, the adjunct, what is it you call him?
Adjutant.
That character. It looked like he gained control over the two kinder that were there by using a mirror, in order to sort of make them believe that he had control over their souls. But he basically lost his mind. And it's a really good performance, I think. It's very big, and he really, really goes for it, right?
But yeah, completely commits to the scenery chewing. I mean, his collapse into madness does seem to happen very, very quickly indeed. But I guess that's why he needs to be doing it. You know, he needs to be the sort of the other side of the threat, if you want. So,
fair, he does seem to be wound very, very tightly, doesn't he, at the very beginning? So I think I buy it. But he's sort of, you almost get this kind of Caligula vibe from him as he's getting slowly more and more mad. The Sanders, Colonel Sanders, would you believe, the leader, goes off in the fantastic sort of encounter suits to sort of try and get to the bottom of the mystery of why people are disappearing. And he gets handed a box, doesn't he?
And what's in the box? Well, for any man that opens it up, madness. So, you know, you've got two different kinds of loopiness going on. You've got Hindle's kind of brand of sort of homemade, wound up craziness. And then you've also got Sanders, who basically is given the box, which presumably is what happened to everyone else that went out wandering in the mad encounter suit. And he sort of comes back as a completely changed character from being the sort of gruff sort of colonel type. He's very mellow and he's very, whatever you'd like to do.
Well, it's this childlike, isn't it? This sort of like, but at the same time, he wants everyone to get along, which is really rather sweet. So yeah, he comes back and he comes back with this box, and the kind of new de facto leader, Hindle, because he's the one with the guns as the head of security, he basically forces Todd, the Nerys Hughes character, and the Doctor to open the box, and. Yeah, after quite a nice fake out where you get a little Jack in the box pops out, they both feel the effect of the box. They come away with it not fine. Todd because she's a woman, and the Doctor I guess because he's a Time Lord and is able to sort of get past that. Either that or it's just because he doesn't have the ego that the other two have, I guess, maybe. So what opening the box does is it connects them with the sort of mind of the Kinder so they can understand what's going on.
So it gives them the impetus to kind of get out of the base and kind of explore the world outside and you know, like, as you were saying, just try and find out exactly what's going on. So they encounter your blind seer character Panna, who gives them an idea of the dangers that are abroad, the fact that there's danger in dreaming alone. The whole point to the Kinder is that they're very much almost like a gestalt entity, you know, everyone's connected to everyone else, so if you do access the Kinder's dream world, you always do that with someone else there to look after you. If you don't do that, then what happens is the things that lurk in the dream world, things like the Mara, can come back into this world and start to cause all kinds of devastation.
Yeah, and the Doctor quickly puts together the fact that, Tegan was at the Dreaming Tree dreaming alone. And the interaction between the Doctor and Panna, sort of the seer, is quite funny actually, because she just regards him as an idiot man. And he sort of, you know, he just sort of good naturedly sort of accepts this sort of like ridicule, but in order to sort of move things along. They sort of go on a vision quest together, don't they?
Yes, they do. Yeah, which basically kind of just underlines the fact that there is danger with the Mara in the world. You know, the Mara is kind of like the anti-life, if you want. So you have this, again, this kind of theatrical thing that kind of shows what happens if the Mara gets loose and the devastation that's likely to be unleashed should he get his way. So the Doctor kind of figures out that the Mara is loose, that the Mara's taken over the new de facto leader, this guy called Aris, and, you know, realizes that what Aris wants and what the Mara want are two different things.
But then when they come back from the dream, they find that Panna has died.
Hmm. just kind of dropped off in her sleep, as it were. But again, because this is effective, the Kinder are a guest out in entity, all Panna's knowledge and a chunk of her personality, by the sound of it, has actually been transferred over to her apprentice. So you still have the whole sort of idiot man thing going on, which is kind of cute again.
Yeah. So, this sense, this, I mean, the whole episode is just soaked with sort of these Zen Buddhist ideas, the sort of circle of life and, reincarnation and things like that. So, yeah, it's just more of this sort of stuff seeded in. And then, so then we come to the sort of final episode where, where the apprentice takes on the mantle of the being the new sort of head wise woman, and, they're trying to stop Aris before things get violent, and also to drive out the Mara. And at this point, you know, if it's not already clear, like Hindle is fully sort of it's fully in La La Land. You know, you have Adric who was sort of kind of pretending to sort of think, oh yeah, these guys got a lot of great ideas, just to kind of pile on. It was getting increasingly sort of like unnerved by just how crazy it all is. But he's literally made himself a god, hasn't he? He's created this whole city out of cardboard and with all these cardboard people. And this bit where one of the people gets his head ripped off. Mm-hmm. So you get this comic book really sort of tragic scene at the same time where Sanders is sort of saying, oh, it's fine, a little bit of glue, you know, it's okay, it's fine, you know, we can fix it. And you have and then Hindle comes out with this classic line, you can't mend people, and it's just a sort of this cry of like, it's just so sad. Mm-hmm. But it looks like he's going to kill everyone because he's decided the way around it is to rig the whole sort of colonial base to explode the moment anyone tries to break in, because that'll learn them when they're dead, and so's he, and everyone's dead. Ha ha, that's a fun game, isn't it? So
yeah. So yeah, you end up with this final confrontation where you've got the Kinder outside the base, ready to attack it with sharpened sticks. Adric, meanwhile, has found a way out of the base in the encounter suit, which he can barely control. So he's sort of stomping around in that. It's firing off guns. Meanwhile, you've got Hindle on the verge of pushing the big red button that's going to blow up everything within a 50-mile radius. And it all comes good in the end. Somehow, it's a little bit confusing. It's a bit of a mess, but it's all kind of just moving towards this final encounter, which is where the Doctor finds a way to drive out the Mara from Aris, which again is done in kind of nice way. It's, you know, it's done with mirrors, which is the way that Hindle was controlling the Kinder in the base in the first place.
Yeah.
So you get this huge, this big theatrical set piece at the end where the Mara is finally revealed in all its glory.
Yeah, and this is the sort of, that scene is kind of the reason why when it was first released, it was sort of, you know, voted by Doctor Who fans as sort of like the worst episode of that season. Because basically when the Mara is revealed, it's revealed as a giant pink rubbery snake.
It is. But I honestly don't mind the rubberiness of it, because at least they've kind of committed to it. You know, they're not trying to do it as kind of a sort of wobbly CSO kind of a thing or anything like that. They actually built the snake. The thing looks to be almost like 20 feet tall in places, and it is, you know, they put sort of swooshy sort of video feedback around it to make it look slightly unreal.
It's just unfortunate that, that's the sort of last impression that people are left with is the slightly rubbishy monster, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's not really about the monster, the Kinder. You know, there's so much more in it. I mean, there's four episodes of stuff here, you know. So they drive at the Mara, and the Mara can't stand its own reflection, because that's evil, can't stand its own reflection, and it's sort of driven away.
Hmm. At least for now, anyway.
Yeah.
So I don't think there's too much spoiler involved to reveal that the Mara does actually return as a credible threat a few seasons later on. In an episode called Snake Dance, which kind of again deals with the fact that it's not been properly gotten rid of. It's still lurking in Tegan to a certain extent, which is kind of a nice idea as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, both written by Christopher Bailey, and that one is more of a kind of is a more conventional Doctor Who story. You could tell that he worked with the script editor Eric Saywood much more closely on that one rather than this one, where this is literally like Eric Saywood's third episode as script editor. He's inheriting a load of scripts and just doing what which means that you get this kind of really, really strange episode, which is almost unlike anything else in classic Doctor Who.
Hmm.
So, I mean, you know, for good and ill, you know, I mean, I personally love Kinder to bits. I love that it's not the sort of the same old thing. Yeah, I think there's a lot to dig into here in terms of the sort of themes and ideas. I think that, you know, Janet Fielding actually gets a lot to do as Tegan here with all this sort of possessed stuff. Because the trouble with Tegan is that, especially during the sort of initial season where she's the companion with the Fifth Doctor, she seems to be spending the whole time moaning that she's there. It's like, oh, can't we go home, Doctor? It seems like a broken record, whereas that's not the case in this one. She gets more to do, so that's not an issue. Even Adric, who is, you know, a trying presence, I think works quite well in this, you know, but you've got some really, really good supporting actors. You know, you've got, you know, likes of Richard Todd, star of Dem Busters, playing Sanders, Neris, who you mentioned, you know, Simon Rouse as Hindu, I think is very good, and Mary Morris as Panna is fantastic. It's weird. This is only like the third episode where Peter Davison is playing the Doctor, and yet this feels like such a Fifth Doctor episode. Even though it was originally written for the Fourth Doctor, it seems weird. I find it very difficult to picture the Fourth Doctor in this story because, it works better with that slightly passive, more passive, more humble figure that the Fifth Doctor is.
Yeah, agreed. More quizzical and more prepared to puzzle stuff out as well, as opposed to the sort of runny round kind of thing that Tom Baker was kind of primed to be doing, especially in his last couple of seasons. No, I agree with you. I think it's quintessential Peter Davison Doctor Who. But at the same time, as you're also saying, it's got a feel all of its own. It's kind of a step into the unknown to a certain extent, and you know there's a lot there to dig into, as you can probably tell by the fact we've been digging into it quite a lot.
Yeah. I mean, Peter Brimwade was one of the strongest sort of directors of the era, I think. And you know, again, he does really good work here. I love all the sort of like zoom into Tegan's eye. You know, they literally break the fourth wall when we go into the dream world. She's looking, staring straight at us. Then we zoom into her eye. And then we're in that nightmare world, and that's, you know, I think that's the strangely the nightmares are what gave me the nightmares as a child, I think, you know, because they are properly creepy. There's some really nice sort of little bits of sort of witty witty dialogue in there, or this sort of an apple a day keeps the this just little sort of throwaway bits and pieces. And yeah, I mean, you know, both, you know, Hindle and Sanders have their moments of sort of scenery tuning, but you know, Neris Hughes is almost like the sort of MVP here of, in terms of that character in the center who just keeps things grounded, you know, just by being quite sort of quietly kind of competent at what she does, and also makes the, you know, because it's, you know, if you sort of read around it, then it's very clear that Christopher Bailey was very annoyed about the changes he had to make to this script, because, you know, Eric Saywood basically wanted things explained more. And this is not a story where it's really interested in explaining a lot. I mean, as you said before, we never really find out what happens to the other members of the colonial expedition. I think it's clear that they must have opened the box and, you know, got lost, you know, lost their mind, or, you know, yeah, as you say, sort of went, you know, walked off into the forest and never came back. But yeah, I quite like that sort of mystery about it. But Neris Hughes is the scientist, is the one asking the question. So she works as a almost pseudo companion here, sort of asking the doctor, you know, well, why is this happening? I mean, he seems quite accepting of a lot of things here, which is interesting because, you know, this is I've seen this sort of compared to sort of some Ursula Le Guin stories in terms of the sort of ideas going on here, and it's very much that kind of sci-fi rather than the sort of harder sort of sci-fi which we got in the sort of in the Christopher H. Bidmead era, which is directly preceded this one in terms of script editing. So it's almost fantasy, isn't it? But there's still those sci-fi ideas in there.
Oh, agreed, definitely. Yeah, I think Ursula Le Guin, you know, the sort of word for world is forest kind of deal, describes it very strongly, actually. The, you know, and sort of playing around with the sort of metaphysical aspect of everything and the unexplainable as well makes life interesting. You know, okay, you've got the sort of scientific thing going on, but there's an awful lot there that's never properly explained, and there's nothing really wrong with that either. You know, it's good to sort of have things open to discussion a little bit, or open to different interpretations, certainly. So, Curiosity, what do you reckon? Have we given you everything that you need on Peter Davison's Doctor Who era, Kinder?
Oh, guys, thank you so much. Yes, it's what a great episode that is. It's so full of mystical weirdness and whooshy sort of special effects and such good fun stuff. And it's creepy in places. And I like the rubber snake. In fact, there's a really interesting planet not that far from here, a couple of parsecs kind of that way. And it's the planet of the pink rubber snake. So I think we should go over there and have a visit, shall we? What do you reckon? Yeah, let's do. Shall we? Okay, right, see
everybody. Okay, right, see you. The Age of SFF was written and performed by Rob Wickens and Clive Ashenden, with additional voice talents of Maria Thomas. Music and editing are by Dalil Hallow at the Creation Station of Havisham, all the way form you can eat. Do you want to know more? Search for the A to Z of SFF on iTunes, Facebook and Twitter, or check out www.theatozofff.com.